We're continuing with the Unshakeable series. A lot of you know that Sharon and I are empty nesters, and so for the last couple of months, Philip's been out of the house for a couple of years already at a group home in Rockford, but now not only Andrew, but also John is away at college, and so we have a lot of time on our own. And before, this was a typical afternoon or evening at the team and household. After everyone's practice was over, it usually wasn't just the boys, John and Andrew, that would come home. It would be a whole passel of them, you know, a whole bunch of kids, because our house was often the destination for all of their friends, which I enjoyed a lot. So over the summer, it would mean swimming. It might mean playing basketball in the driveway. It might mean spike ball in the backyard. It probably meant that a lot of them would also be there to eat as well. So we had all the eating, and because boys in particular aren't really good at putting their dishes away, you know, herding all that together and washing the dishes, and then probably watching sports on television after that, and maybe some video games. So it was always a lot of commotion, which we enjoyed a lot. And now I come home in the evenings, and it is a very empty and quiet house. And I have to admit, I don't like it. Now, don't get me wrong. I love my wife. I love visiting with my wife. But our conversations kind of go along the same way all the time. Has Andrew or John texted you yet today? And often we have to text them to remind them to text us. And well, I think it's a picture, really, of what our culture is. Not everyone's an empty nester, of course, but our society and our culture has changed, and I've noticed this change myself. Not as abruptly as it is being an empty nester, but over the last 20 or 25 years as we have moved from community to community. And I don't think it's just the places that we've lived in. For example, when we were in Atlanta, before we were here, I had a neighbor that I would talk to across the fence. And we would talk in particular about gardening, because he was from India and they didn't have any land whatsoever in India, and so he really didn't know how to plant anything or how to take care of anything. So we would talk a lot about that. And inevitably, because he knew that I was a pastor, we would talk about Jesus because he was a Hindu. So we had those conversations. Before that, when we were in St. Louis, it was a little different yet. It wasn't the conversations over the fence. But for the most part, all the neighbors would gather in the front yard. Instead of being in the back porch or on the back patio or unseen, everyone would be on the front porch, and even would take the lawn chairs into the street, and we would have impromptu block parties. Now, we lived on a street where there wasn't a lot of car traffic, and you could do that, and the kids were often playing hockey out in front, you know, with the rollerblades and all of that, and someone would bring some beverages, and pretty soon you'd have a nice little party. Well, things have changed over the years. If you put the notes up, let's take a look at what George Gallup has to say about America today. So if you'll put that up on the screen. First of all, he says, Americans as a whole are physically detached from one another. Outside of work, we are physically detached. Now, here's a scenario in my neighborhood, probably not that much different from yours. If you get up at the right time in the morning and you go outside, you see all the garage doors go up, right? And the car or cars pull out, and the parents go to work, and the kids get on the bus, and they go to school. And then there's no activity whatsoever during the week until about 5 or 6 o'clock, and then the whole scenario repeats itself. And the garage doors go up, and the cars go back in, and you don't see anybody. Americans as a whole are truly physically as well as emotionally detached from one another. If you go to the next. Now, here's a little quiz for you. You know, most of us don't know the names of our neighbors. Think of the five people who live either across the street from you or on either side of you. So five neighbors on one side, five neighbors on the other. Can you actually name them? Do you know all the people in the family or just the dog by the name you gave it when it got into your garbage? Right? And because most of us don't even know the names of our neighbors, let alone their lives, there's a great sense of isolation. We feel like we are in this life alone. Now, one of the central needs, according to George Gallup, and I think we would agree with this, one of the central needs of our time, so these days, is an intimate and healthy community. We were built for community. God created us for community. From the very beginning, God said to Adam, it's not good for you or anyone else to be alone. You need each other. Now I want to talk to the men for just a minute. Men especially have many acquaintances, but few friends. And so we're in fantasy football leagues, and we have people that we know at work, and we might play on a recreation basketball or softball league. We might text people from time to time, but we don't have friends like we once did. I remember when I was in high school as a freshman, I played football, and even though it was only 15 miles away from home, it seemed like it was 1,500 miles. I was at the boarding school, and for the first 2 weeks before school started, the whole team got together and lived literally in this big white house. No air conditioning and three practices a day. And I can remember how lonely and isolated I felt because my twin brother, who was supposed to play football, had hurt himself in a farming accident. He actually got run over by a hay wagon, and so it took him a few weeks to recover. Long story, another sermon. So anyway, so he's not there. My oldest brother is a senior, so he's not supposed to fraternize with the freshmen, right? In fact, he's supposed to beat up on us in practice every day, which he dutifully did, by the way, because we were a small school and everybody played together. So I felt very isolated. So a couple of my freshman buddies and I formed a pack. We were going to be there for each other. And so every day after practice, we would go down to the Creamy Freeze in Concordia, Missouri, and get a nice big sundae. Those were friends over the next 4 years and still friends today. And you probably have some friends like that as well. Unfortunately, we don't have nearly enough. Instead, what happens to men is this. Society trains men to be loners. What was the old TV show? The Lone what? The Lone Ranger, right? The masked man, strong silent type, John Wayne and all those old actors, even today, the heroes are often loners. And that's what society teaches us to be. Now let's go back to our Bible lesson for today. Go back to the Old Testament. Let me paint the picture for you. It's about 1400 B.C. The people of Israel have just been let go by Pharaoh. Now, there were 10 plagues because Pharaoh's heart kept getting hardened. And he wouldn't let God's people go after 400 years of slavery. Until finally the last plague and the firstborn of the Egyptians are killed by the angel of death. So finally, Pharaoh lets them all go. And they haven't been but just a little bit out of the camp, worshiping on Mount Sinai. And now they're about to cross the Red Sea. And again, Pharaoh changes his mind. So he sends his army out after them. And miraculously, God parts the Red Sea. 2 million people cross. Now that's a big congregation, isn't it? 2 million. And then the waters come back and they drown all of the army of Pharaoh. And so off the people go on to the promised land of Canaan. But their conflict is not over because they are going through other people's pastures. Now, where I grew up, that was forbidden. You couldn't send your people or your cows through another farmer's pasture without permission. And so there is one people in particular. They are the Amalekites that we just heard about in our reading. But what we may not remember about the Amalekites is that they are the descendants of Esau. Now, who's Esau? Jacob's brother. How did Jacob and Esau get along, by the way? Not so well. Remember that Jacob had stolen Esau's birthright, his blessing. And he'd also lied to his father Isaac in the process. So not only did they not get along, but their descendants did not get along, and their descendants did not get along. And so the Amalekites see these Israelites, these descendants of Jacob, marching through their land, and so they waged war. Now, of course, God is with Israel. And so he tells the leader, which is Moses, a very old man by now, go up to this mountain and hold your hands up, hold your staff, which was known as the banner of Yahweh. Yahweh is the Lord. His name, I am who I am, because there's no other way to describe God. He is who he is. And as long as you hold up that staff, then Joshua, who is leading the army, will win. But whenever your arms go down, then your enemy will prevail. So what's going to happen naturally? I can't stand up in three church services on Sunday without my back getting sore. And Moses is a whole lot older than I am. He needs to sit down. Oh, my aching arthritic back. Oh, and the arms go with it, right? And so Israel is losing. So Aaron and Hur, Moses' brother and one of the elders of the congregation, hold Moses' hands up. And Israel wins the war. Now, what's the point for us? Let's go back to our notes. What does this mean for us? Aaron and Hur represent those of our generation who hold us up. We all need those leaders like Moses who go out in front, but we need those as well to give him strength when he doesn't have it, to fill him with faith when it isn't there. So here's the question for us now. Who are our enemies? It's not the Amalekites. It's not the descendants of Esau, or is it? The enemies of God's people today. It's the devil, right? And the world, all of those who are not following Christ, the Amalekites, if you will, and even our own sinful flesh. Now, what we often miss in this little story, we get the part that when Moses' hands are up, when the banner of Yahweh is lifted high, that God's power is upon his people and the Israelites prevail. And we may even get that when Moses' hands begin to fall, that the people also begin to falter. But what we miss is that when those hands go down, when there isn't someone to lift up Moses, then the enemy increases and prevails. And so every generation needs these Aarons and these Hurs who are lifting people up, who are praying for God's power. If you put the note up there, because where does the power really come from? Not from Moses. He's a man. He's just lifting up the banner of Yahweh, not from Aaron and Hur. They're just holding up Moses' arm. And not even from Joshua, who is fighting the battle. No, the power always comes from God. In the Old Testament, it was the staff, the symbol of God's power for us. The power is in the cross. Because that is the instrument that God used to defeat our enemies, sin and death and the devil. And through that resurrection of his one and only Son, God proclaimed the victory. The victory that is available to us not only for eternity in heaven, but right now, every day against those enemies, even when we are not strong, even when we are weak, and even when our faith has waned. So there are two questions we need to ask this morning. First one is this: who are your Aarons and Hurs? Because we're all a Moses to one degree or another. We're leading something. Maybe we're leading our family. Maybe we're leading at work. Maybe we're leading in our community. We're all leading our own lives, aren't we? We need Aarons and Hurs because we are not always enough. Our faith is not always enough. Our strength is not always enough. So first of all, who are your Aarons and Hurs in your family? How many parents in here today? Any parents? A lot of you are parents. I don't know if you knew this or not, but raising children is a challenge. Did you know that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe just my children. I don't know. It's a challenge, isn't it? Have any babies in here this morning? Parents with babies, raise your hand. A couple of you. Yeah. Anybody remember the teething years? Yep. Hard to sleep during those teething years. Hard for the baby to sleep because of the pain there in the gums. Hard for the parents to sleep. My dad told me, as we were raising Philip, he told me that there would be one sleepless night for every tooth. So I said, that means Philip must have 150 teeth. A few more sleepless nights than the teeth coming in. Raising children is a challenge. Reminds me of the old story of the elderly gentleman who came to this mother of six home, knocked on the door, and he said, I'm raising funds and taking donations for the children's home. And he thought that maybe she could help out. So, can you make a donation? Well, absolutely, she said. Do you want two girls or two boys? Don't you feel like that sometimes? You just want to get rid of them all? Not really. I'm kidding. We love our children. But raising children is most certainly a challenge. I want to read to you this morning. This is from John Ortberg, a pastor and author. He wrote this a few years back. He said, I look in on my children as they sleep at night, and I think of the kind of father I want to be, emphasis on want to be. I want to create moments of magic. I want them to remember laughing until the tears flow. I want to have slow, sweet talks with them as they're getting ready to close their eyes. I want to chase fireflies with them, teach them to play tennis, have food fights, and hold them and pray for them in a way that makes them feel cherished. After all, the best parents reflect the love of Jesus. And isn't that the case? Isn't that what we all want to do? Well, then he goes on and he says, I look in on them and I remember how the day really went. I remember how they were trapped in a fight over a game and I walked out of the room because I didn't want to spend the energy needed to teach them how to resolve conflict. And I remember how my daughter spilled cherry punch at dinner and I yelled at her, as if she had revealed some deep character flaw. I yelled at her even though I spill things all the time and no one yells at me. I yelled at her to tell the truth, he writes, because I'm big and she's little and I can get away with it. I remember how at nights I didn't have slow, sweet talks, but merely rushed the children off to bed so I could have more time to myself. Most of us have been there, haven't we? We need to admit that we haven't always been the best reflection of the love of Jesus. And that's when we need those Aarons and Hurs. When our strength is not enough, we need to rely on the strength of others. When our faith is not great enough, we need to borrow the faith of others. Most certainly in our families, and sometimes it is biological family. It's grandparents, it's It's brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles. And sometimes it's mentors. Those who've already done it. Those who can encourage you and help you as parents to understand that you haven't blown it completely. And there's still a chance. There's still an opportunity that with God's power, these children can be raised and lifted up into the people that God would have them to be. But not only among our family, but also among our friends. In the Gospel of Mark, chapter 2, there are four friends that take a man to see Jesus. It was in Capernaum, and the house where Jesus was staying was full. Kind of like the clinic yesterday at one point. It's hard to get in the front door, big line out the front. Well, you couldn't even get in the front door because there were so many people. So instead, these four friends took their friend, who also happened to be paralyzed, lying on a stretcher. And they hoisted him up to the roof, and they made an opening, and they lowered him down to Jesus. And we are told that Jesus then healed him, not because of the faith of the paralyzed man, but because of the faith of the four friends. These are Aaron's and hers, lifting up the one who is weak in his time of need, providing their strength and their faith to fill the gap. There's an online devotion called Daily Encounter. It's written by a man named Dick Innes. And he talks recently in one of his posts about what a friend truly is. And he uses the example of the Native American Indians, people whose language is different than the Europeans who came over, the French and the English and the Spanish. We have a very short word for friend, just a few letters long. The Indian word for friend, and you can put it up there, is one who lends a listening ear, one who carries my sorrows on his back, and one who lifts me up in prayer. Do you have any friends like that? Not just acquaintances, but people that you can call on in the middle of the night. People who will be there when you are weak to lift you up. People who are constantly praying on your behalf to the Lord. If you don't have an Aaron or her in your life, then you need to go find one. And how do you do that? Well, you first become an Aaron or a her to someone else. And that's our last question. For whom are you an Aaron or a her? Because not only do we need others to lift us up, we certainly are in that position many times in our own life as well. Now, I grew up on a farm and we had all kinds of animals, pigs and cows and dogs and cats and chickens, a few geese and occasional horse. My dad told me that a horse could pull approximately 1 ton in a wagon. So how many tons do you think two horses could pull? Any guesses? Logic says 2. The answer is 23. Because when two are pulling together, their strength is exponential. We know that in the animal world, talking about those geese, it's that time of the year. If you look outside, there's the geese. What are they flying in? A V formation. Of course, because when they get tired, the lead goose then goes to the back and another one takes his place. Not only that, but they're also honking to do what? To encourage one another. I don't know what it sounds like in goose language. You can make it. You can do it. We all need that. We all need that Aaron or her. We all need that friend to lift us up in time of need. And I'll close with this. There was a man by the name of Dawson Trotman, and he had begun the Navigators years ago. It was a Bible study group that was on many college campuses and among many Christian businessmen. He had a camp in New York where the kids of New York City would come out and they would see God's beautiful creation as well as learn about Jesus from the Bible. And there was a lake there and they would often go out on a boat. Well, one time there were too many people on that boat, and when several of them got up, it kind of rocked the boat and two others fell in the water. Dawson Trotman was not a good swimmer, and yet he jumped in after these two individuals, two girls. And he dog paddled out to the one, and he put his arms around her, and he kicked back with his feet. And he got her back to the boat, and he lifted her up to safety. And then he jumped back in, and he went in after the second girl. And though she was half drowned and fighting him the whole way, he got her back to the boat, and he lifted her up. And she was rescued. But then he was completely exhausted and he slipped back down into the water. And no one was able to save him. Billy Graham did the funeral. And Time magazine had an article. In their next edition, there was a picture of Dawson Trotman on the cover. And the caption underneath read like this. Dawson Trotman, he was always lifting someone up. For whom are you, an Aaron or a Her? What nameless, faceless neighbor do you know that needs a helping hand, that needs to know the love of Jesus? And ask yourself who you can lift up. Even as you have been lifted up yourself. Lean on me, the old song goes. For when I am not strong, you can be my friend, so I can carry on. That's our community of faith here at Emmanuel. Sometimes you will be Moses. And sometimes you will be Aaron or Her. May God grant that through this community of faith that we're constantly holding people up. For Jesus' sake. Amen.